Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, November 15th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Travel Junos Liz Perry and Kirk Stagg will be here to tell us about the impact of meetings and conferences on Juno. Zonta Kahini Assistant Principal Christy Germain will highlight the middle school Icebreakers basketball tournament. We'll hear about the collaboration between Greg Chaney, the Goldtown Theater, and Perseverance Theater to screen the Empty Chair documentary. And Clint Farr will be here to tell us about the second edition of Beers of the North and his book signing this Saturday. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon, currently 40 degrees at Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it has determined additional discussion and analysis are needed before deciding whether or not to grant an easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross a waterway in North Dakota. The agency announced Monday it completed its review. It started in early September and is inviting the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe to take part in discussions. The tribe is opposing the pipeline, saying it's a threat to water and the environment, and has been calling on the Obama administration to stop the project. Standing Rock Sioux Chairman Dave Archambault says while the decision was not 100% what the tribe had hoped for, he says it's clear President Obama is listening. The chairman is encouraging their supporters camped near the reservation and others across the country to be peaceful and prayerful in their opposition. The company behind the project says the pipeline provides jobs and will assist with U.S. energy independence. Energy Transfer Partners is confident the pipeline will be finished, including with support from the next presidential administration. Meanwhile, people across the country are taking part in events today and what's being called a National Day of Action against the pipeline. Native American and environmental groups helped organize events and say there are events in every state and internationally. Members of the Nez Perce tribe are among those planning to provide comment at a public meeting Wednesday in Lewiston, Idaho, on the future of four dams on the Lower Snake River. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Nez Perce tribe members believe the best way to restore salmon and steelhead to their Idaho communities is by breaching the four Lower River Snake dams. Elliot Moffitt, president of NIMIPU Protecting the Environment, a nonprofit that defends the treaty rights and lands of the Nez Perce tribe, says federal agencies have not been able to come up with a viable way to help salmon on the river.
All of these other methods and alternatives have been tried to date, and the fish are not returning. So as tribal members, we cannot exercise our treaty rights to fish, for an example, and utilize the salmon as we have in our past, in our culture and tradition.
In the past, dam managers have used fish ladders and other methods to try to help salmon up the river. Nez Perce members say the Treaty of 1855 guarantees their fishing rights on the Snake River. Supporters of the dam say they provide a source of clean energy and transportation for crops. A court ruling in May set in motion the current round of public hearings in Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Oregon on what to do with the Lower Snake River dams, and the federal judge who issued the ruling has told agencies that breaching the dams must be an option. Moffitt says salmon are at risk from a combination of climate change and the effects from the dams, and that after the recent presidential election, a decision needs to be made soon to save the salmon.
We believe that there's going to be reductions in climate change policies. We oppose that, and so we think now is the time to act, and we hope to be gathering others' support on this issue as well.
NIMIPU Protecting the Environment has started a petition online to gather support for removing the dams. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma are offering new veteran ID cards. The cards feature the branch in which the veteran served, along with tribal affiliation. The initiative is in honor of Native American Heritage Month and last week's Veterans Holiday. The Tribal Enrollment Office has identified about 300 veterans in its recently reestablished Office of Veterans Affairs. Officials say there are still more veterans of the more than 12,000 enrolled Cheyenne and Arapaho citizens and are hoping the new cards will be an incentive to come into the office. The IDs were ready just in time for Veterans Day. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com. Support by Northern Arizona University, a university committed to serving Native American students, offering opportunity in every direction, in Flagstaff, at community colleges around the state, and online. Learn more at nau.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, November 15th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, joining me in the studio now, Liz Perry. She's the president and CEO of Travel Juno, and Kirk Stagg, he is the convention sales manager. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Let's start with you, Liz. Tell us a little bit about Travel Juno, what it used to be and what it is now.
Well, Travel Juno has actually been in existence for about 30 years, formed originally as the Juno Convention and Visitors Bureau, JCVB for short, and its mission is to basically bring economic benefit to the city of Juno by encouraging independent travel and enhancing Juno as a visitor destination year-round.
So interesting, you know, when we think of travel to Juno, a lot of what we think of course, is cruise ship travel, Independent travel is very important as well, right?
It certainly is, because we know that independent travelers will tend to spend more. They fill our hotels. They rent cars. They just tend to be a little more adventurous, and they want to get off the beaten track of where the cruise ship passengers go. So it's a different demographic. And included in that group would be our meeting and convention attendees because of the impact that they have in terms of helping out our caterers, keeping Centennial Hall booked, and so on. So the visitor industry has a big impact on Juno and is actually Juno's third largest employer, if you will, and makes up about 20% of CBJ's sales tax.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. And that's where you come in, Kirk, right? You're the convention sales manager. We want people to have meetings and conventions here, don't we?
We do. I mean, and what a great place to have a meeting. You know, meetings these days, nobody really remembers what the meeting was, but they remember after the meeting. And, you know, you look outside of Juneau, we've got, you know, wildlife, glaciers, mountains. You know, it's a great place to go to have a meeting. So,
okay. What are a few things that the organization's doing to get the word out?
Well, in terms of getting visitor traffic in, we are really making a much more conscious effort to pose Juno as a year-round destination, and we bring Eagle Crest into the fold and let people know it's a great place to go skiing, and we always talk about our thriving arts culture, the growing food scene in Juno, so we want to get folks here to enjoy that side of Juno as well. And in terms of meetings and conventions, we try to tap meeting planners all over the U.S. And inside of Alaska to consider Juno. It's only 2.5 hours north of Seattle. We have partnerships with Alaska Airlines and great relationships with our hoteliers to make good deals for their attendees in terms of the properties that they need and basically assist them in the planning once they get here.
Okay. Tell us about Travel Juno itself. Where are you located, and what kind of an organization are you? Who supports you, that kind of thing?
We are a 501c6 nonprofit organization, much like the Chamber of Commerce is. We are administrative offices are located at 800 Glacier Avenue, so we're on the corner of Glacier and Willoughby. We have visitor information centers that are open. Two of them are open seasonally down on the docks at the cruise ship terminal, and we have a kiosk that is open adjacent to the library. We also have a kiosk that is available right off baggage claim at the airport and a self-serve kiosk at the ferry terminal as well. So we keep those places stocked with downtown walking maps, our travel guides, other pieces of information and literature, rack cards from our members to give people the information they need to select what they want to do in Juno.
Okay. Kirk, can you tell me about a couple of the successful conventions that we do have here in Juneau right now, or meetings, and tell us about maybe what we hope to get here in the future?
We just had PennWest was a large waste management group that just came, and they were just here in October. And the amazing thing was, you know, they came during that amazing stint of weather that we had. And so, you know, they're very happy. And, you know, again, we offer things that they just don't get places down south. I mean, I think we're the only city in the world that has a glacier within the city limits, you know, and our food scene, we were just in Vogue magazine, we're on Thrillist. So even though we're not very big, we're very compact, we're safe, you know, and you go to these other large cities, you know, it takes you, you know, all day to get somewhere after your meeting or things like that. We're here in Juneau, it's 5 to 10 minutes. We have a very high level meeting coming. It's the Arctic Council, where the 8 countries of the Arctic Council are coming to meet in Juneau in March. And it should be very exciting. So, you know, you have the State Department organizing it. They're going to be here for 3 days. You know, so these are the kind of things that, you know, put Juneau on the map.
Sure. And what kind of things can you help an organization with if they call you and express interest? What are things that you can help them with?
Hotels, rooms, activities, you name it. We're kind of their conduit, you know, to what's going on in the city. And we're free. I mean, that's the best thing. I think people don't really realize that we're, you know, here to help them organize their event and at no cost to them. So, you know, we're their best first one call stop shopping.
Okay. Maybe some of our listeners, maybe here in Juneau, we should all work to get our friends from down south to start bringing their meetings here.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we actually have a program in place to encourage locals to do just that. Our Bring It Home program is designed to provide some incentives to the meeting planners, and if they hit a threshold of at least 150 to 200 meetings, room nights per meeting, then we can start adding additional services. As Kirk said, we provide a lot of services for free regardless of the size of the meeting. If you need bids on hotel rooms, bids on caterers, you need collaterals, we can help you with all of that, and we can even help avoid pitfalls that planners can fall into in just putting the logistics together. With the Bring It Home program, we want Juneau residents who belong to professional organizations, fraternal associations, to call us about incentives that we can provide and services we can provide. And depending on the size of the meeting, that Juneau resident can be have their name put into a drawing for Alaska Airlines tickets anywhere Alaska Airlines flies. And that would be our thank you for bringing that meeting home to Juneau.
How small of sort of organizations or parties do you work with? For example, if somebody was having a wedding here in Juneau, is that somebody that you would work with?
Well, what we would do with a wedding is provide them and make referrals to wedding planners here in town. And we have planners who we partner with through Travel Juneau, and we would make those referrals and make sure that they got all of the information they needed in terms of getting hotels and again, making sure that that path was straightened out for them.
Okay. If somebody wants more information or wants to get involved, what is the best way they can do that?
They can go to our website, which is traveljuneau.com. They can also, for example, if they're interested in a meeting, they should call Kirk at 586-1749. He is also available at kirk.stag@traveljuneau.com. And they can call our general line, which is 586-2201, if they have general questions about what things there are to do in Juneau for friends and family. And I would encourage residents also to keep an eye out for our travel fair, which happens generally one of the first weekends in April. That is a great time for the community to turn out and take advantage of local discounts that our members will be providing, and learn what is new in Juneau to do and what they can do with friends and family.
Excellent. And I know you'll be back. You come back every couple of weeks here and keep us informed here on Travel Tuesdays. We sure appreciate your time. And we can talk more about that in particular in April. So looking forward to that as well. Is there anything we're missing today? Anything else you'd like to add?
I think that's it. We just want Juneau to know that meetings mean business. Meetings mean more revenue to Juneau. And every meeting counts. So we are happy to work with them to get those into town.
All right, that's Liz Perry. She's the president and CEO of Travel Juno, and Kirk Stagg, he's the convention sales manager. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Support provided by Kindred Post, a full-service post office, gift shop, and community gathering space located downtown at 145 South Franklin Street and open 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. More information at kindredpost.com or on Instagram at @kindred_post.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, November 15th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 20 minutes after the hour. Joining me on in the show, in the studio here now, is Assistant Principal at Zonta Kahini, Christy Germain. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're here to talk about middle school basketball and the Icebreakers basketball tournament coming up. Tell us a little bit about middle school basketball. Is a lot of kids participate in that?
We do have a lot of students participating. And at both Santa Kahini and Floyd Dryden Middle Schools, we have a competitive team, which we call our A team, and they play interscholastically. And then we also have an intramural or developmental program. And it 65 to 80 kids at each school are participating in basketball right now. And students at the charter school in Montessori in the school district are welcome to join our Floyd Dryden and Santa Kahini teams as well.
As an administrator, what do you see as the benefits for kids playing basketball?
Oh, there are a lot of benefits. Certainly interpersonally, students getting a chance to have positive interactions with their peers, and they're learning team building, practicing, working toward a goal, and just the skill development that comes with the basketball program. It's also supporting our academics. Our students are meeting grade requirements, the same as they would need to in high school and certainly in college. And just the structure, prioritizing their time is really important for middle school students as they look at organization, meeting their responsibilities. And it is just a really fun time. We have some great coaches this year and the camaraderie that comes with the team.
Great. And probably great exercise, right?
That definitely is a benefit.
So tell us about this tournament, Icebreakers.
Okay. Well, the Icebreaker tournament really has had a few different names. It's been the Icebreaker for a few years, and we invite Southeast Alaska teams. This year, we're really excited. We'll have 18 teams in the bracket. We are getting guests from Angoon, Haines, Blatchley Middle School in Sitka, and Skagway, in addition to our Santa Kahini and Floyd Dryden teams. We'll have both an A bracket and a B bracket for boys and girls.
So this is December 2nd and 3rd, a Friday and Saturday at DZ.
Mm-hmm.
And the public is totally invited, right?
Yes, the public is welcome. We will be playing basketball on Friday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Santa Kahini is blessed with a large gym. We're able to run three courts at the same time. And then on Saturday, we'll start again at 8 a.m. and we'll have our final championship games by 5 o'clock and then an awards ceremony to close the tournament.
Beyond all the benefits that you mentioned earlier, it must be neat for the kids to meet other kids from different communities.
Definitely. And what we see a lot is our own students who have moved to Juneau or have lived sometime in other communities. They get to reconnect with their friends. And, you know, you just had Travel Juneau on the program previously, and we recognize that as Juneau, we're the big community in Southeast Alaska, and we play a role as host and hostess for our Southeast neighbors to come and play some basketball because we know Southeast loves basketball.
Okay. It can't be cheap for all these kids to get here, and I bet you've had help.
We have had help. You know, our biggest sponsor has been JDHS Booster Clubs for their basketball programs, specifically the Rebounders Club and the Fast Break Club. And then also we have had sponsorship in the past from Thunder Mountain's teams, and they have the full court and the three-point booster club and Hoop Time, which is not affiliated with the school, but they have also supported our tournament.
Okay. For more information, I understand that some of your students are making a website?
That's right. Dave Ringel is one of our teachers at Santa Kahini, and he has a technology class, and his technology class is looking for real-world applications of their technology. So they are going to put together a website, which will be linked on our Santa Kahini website. They'll keep track of scores and games and the standing in the bracket and other information that they can provide.
Nice practical way, right?
Yes, definitely. And junoschools.org is the main website for our school district. Santa Kahini is then linked, and the Icebreaker Tournament will be linked from the Santa Kahini page.
Okay, so does this tournament represent sort of the end of the regular season?
It is the end of the regular season for our basketball teams. And actually this week on Thursday, which is Thursday the 17th, we have our last regular season games before the tournament. Our A teams will be playing at Floyd Dryden with the girls at 3:30 and the boys starting at 4:30. And while that is happening, we've invited all of the intramural Floyd Dryden and Santa Kahini players to Santa Kahini's gym, and we'll be running a jamboree or round robin play from 3 to 4:30 this Thursday.
Again, what's the website if people want information on these games?
junoschools.org, and then link to Santa Kahini's page.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add about the tournament, basketball? And also, what's next in the season?
So for middle school athletics, we'll have our wrestling start in January, and we do also have a rifle club.
Okay. And anything else you want to add about the basketball or the tournament?
I would just like to invite community members who are interested. You are welcome. We'd love to have you. I'm cheering on our players. And again, 8 to 8 all day Friday, December 2nd, and 8 to 5 on Saturday the 3rd.
All right. Christy Germain of Zantikini, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, man, who's that cat coming down the street?
I don't know, but it sounds to me like that wicked man with the bone.
Sure having himself a ball.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, November 15th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 28 minutes after the hour, and I've been joined in the studio now by Amy O'Neill Houck and also Greg Chaney. He's a filmmaker. Amy is a big part of Perseverance Theater. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, nice to have you. This is a very interesting and I would say powerful collaboration that Perseverance and you are doing. Greg, you just finished, or I'm not sure exactly when you finished, the Empty Chair documentary.
It's been about a year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we just got to talk to Art Roach yesterday, Amy, and Hold These Truths is playing at Perseverance right now.
Opening this week, yep.
Tell us briefly about Hold These Truths and how you connected with Greg and why.
Absolutely. Hold These Truths is the story of Gordon Hirabayashi, who is one of the three people who legally challenged the internment of Japanese people. He challenged his own internment during World War II. And it's his story of his 60-year fight for vindication. When we decided to do the play, you know, we knew already that there was a strong connection to the story of Japanese internment and of internment in general, because Alaska Native people were also interned during World War II. And we wanted to connect the play to that story and thought immediately of Greg and his documentary and the Empty Chair Project, which has been going on in Juneau for some time now.
Okay, thank you. Greg, tell us about the documentary and when you started filming it, when the idea was sparked for you. I know you've been making movies for a long time.
Yeah, the Empty Chair story is a really wonderful Juno story, and I kind of came in, I guess, in the middle of it. The Empty Chair Committee formed because two of the people who had gone to school with a local Japanese-American woman all through school didn't realize that she'd been interned until at a high school reunion several years later. So it was something nobody ever talked about. And then the fact that this Juneau School District set aside an empty chair for the valedictorian of the graduating class, John Tanaka, because he had been interned was actually an act of civil disobedience at the time. This was World War II. The very beginning, Japan had just attacked Pearl Harbor. Alaska was being invaded. There wasn't a whole lot of sympathy for the Japanese Americans at the time, and the Juneau School Board, along with other citizens, took a very strong stand to say it was unconstitutional, immoral to intern these people. And also like to point out, when the empty chair was set aside, there were no Japanese Americans left in Juneau. They were making a statement for the rest of the community. So it's a wonderful story. It's a very Juneau-oriented story, but it sprawls out very quickly into the entire internment story, because although they start here, the people who are interned, and I'm talking about the documentary now, they end up in Idaho, in Minidoka camp there. But then two of the guys from Juneau end up in the U.S. military. One ends up in Europe, and the other ends up in Japan. So it gets very broad very quickly, and it was really hard to keep the documentary into a concise little story, because the story of Japanese internment takes over thousands of people's lives.
What was it about the story that spoke to you personally to take this on as
a
documentary?
Well, I think it was the fact that the Juneau community took such a strong stand, and the empty chair was set aside, and that was pretty visual. But there were a lot of things that were done at a much lower level that were also very powerful, and the support the local community showed to these the Japanese Americans from Juneau was powerful, and it was one of those stories you just like you hear it and you go, wow, I really would like to make a documentary about this and bring the story out to other people. And in the times we're living in right now, I think it challenges all of us to think about what we can do and to make sure that our Constitution is upheld and just how we can support our neighbors.
Amy, have you had a chance to see it yet?
No, I'm going to see it tonight for the first time.
Where are you going to see it?
At the Gold Town Nickelodeon at 7 p.m.
Okay, and so that's tonight, one night only, or two nights?
That's correct.
It's just one night. It's been shown in Juneau before, so it's a companion piece with the play. I think it's a wonderful story to go with the play. But one night is good, especially for those folks who haven't seen it yet. Another opportunity, and afterwards we're going to have a Q&A. Which I think is probably the most important part, is just to kind of reflect on what happened back then and who we are as a community. And I always, every time I show it and we have a Q&A, I always want to talk to the audience about what our responsibility is as citizens of the United States to look out for the oppressed and especially our neighbors, and to make sure that we could step up if something like that happened. Not easy to do. Not easy. It's really easy to underestimate what they did back then.
You may have just answered my next question, which is, what was the most fulfilling part of producing this documentary for you?
Well, actually, the most fulfilling part is, I've shown it Anchorage, Juneau, of course, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. After every showing, actually Eugene, Oregon, after every showing I've had, there's been one or two elderly Japanese Americans who have come up to me and said, thank you for telling our story. These are not Junoites. These are just people who were caught up in that same event. And that's always been very powerful.
Okay. So individuals can go to the show tonight, right, at the Gold Town at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. Wonderful opportunity there. Great theater. Q&A involved with the screening. And then tomorrow night is a preview, right, of
Thursday.
Hold These Truths?
Yeah.
or excuse me, Thursday.
But yeah, Thursday is a preview. It's our only preview for the show, so it's a great chance to see it ahead of the opening. And Greg is going to be at the theater to kind of circle back around to the film and connect the play and the film with Greg Watanabe, who is our actor in Hold These Truths.
And did Art maybe say that the playwright is also going to be there?
The playwright will also be there Thursday.
Excellent. Yeah.
Very exciting. Playwright and filmmaker all in one place.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you two so much for coming on the show. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about the documentary or the play?
It's free to come this evening. We're going to pass the hat to help cover the costs of the Gold Town, but we'd love to have you come.
Great. Greg?
Yeah, it's going to be a great opportunity to have a little conversation after the film about Juneau's history, the people who lived here, and how the community was built.
If somebody can't come tonight, can they find the documentary? Where can they find it?
It's for sale at the City Museum.
Okay.
And so that's probably the best local location. If you want to order it online, it's available through the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. You can order it from their bookstore.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 15th of November, 2016. It's the birthday of the newspaper columnist Franklin Pierce Adams, born Chicago, 1881, had a very popular column entitled The Conning Tower, which he signed with his initials, FPA, remembered now mainly for the fact that it launched the careers of Dorothy Parker and James Thurber. It's the birthday of Georgia O'Keeffe, the painter, born Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, 1887. She lived in New York for a time. It was there she started to paint the enormous flowers for which she is best known. But she took a trip out to Taos, New Mexico, and she came to love the desert. She felt that the thin, dry air enabled her to see farther, and she devoted much of the rest of her career to painting desert scenery. Georgia O'Keeffe, who said, "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." It's the birthday of Marianne Moore, born Kirkwood, Missouri, 1887. Her father was an engineer and inventor, spent his life trying to build a smokeless furnace. When his business failed, he had a nervous breakdown. He had to go to an institution for the mentally ill. Marianne Moore was born just after her parents had separated, and she never met her father. She went to Bryn Mawr College, where she majored in biology, and where working in a laboratory had a profound effect on her writing. Marianne Moore, who said, "Precision, economy of statement, logic, drawing and identifying liberated my imagination." It was on this day, 1940, 75,000 men were called to armed forces duty under the first peacetime conscription in American history. The draft, never popular in America. In 1939, a poll had shown only 35% of Americans approved of a draft. But by 1940, with Hitler's army invading, occupying Poland and France, support for a draft had gone up to 92%. So in October of 1940, 16 million young men registered with the Selective Service, the first 75,000 draftees called up to service on this day, 1940. And it's the birthday of the poet Ted Barragan, born Providence, Rhode Island, 1934, served in the Korean War, went to college, University of Tulsa, then went to live on the Lower East Side of New York City. In the early 60s, began writing his collection of 14-line poems called The Sonnets, which came out in 1964. It was a big success. Wrote the first 6 sonnets in one night, then wrote 2 or 3 per day for about 3 months. Here's a poem for today by Michelle Y. Burke, Trick of the Light. In France, the pickpockets ask tourists to sign petitions against social injustice, then run their hands over their intimate belongings, gentle and needy as lovers. It's hard to judge them harshly, such artistry. Even the rush hour crowd hurrying toward the downtown sea parts for the woman in checkered spandex, twirling a hula hoop about her waist while standing on her head. Dear unobservant God, do not snuff us out. We are beautiful and strange. Trick of the Light, a poem by Michelle Y. Burke from Animal Purpose, published by Ohio University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, November 15th. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 19 minutes until the top of the hour. Joining me in the studio now is writer, actor,
Transportation planner.
Transportation planner.
Dad.
Clint Farr.
Hello.
Author of the second edition of Beers of the North.
Yes. Co-authored this with Colleen Mundor. Lives down in Seattle and is an author who writes a lot for the ADN on aviation in Alaska. Yeah.
You know, I think of successful writers, they have to read a lot.
Yeah.
They have to write a
lot. If I had time to read, I would.
And they have to research a lot.
Sure. Research is important in writing. So it's really the single most important thing you can do.
This book, did you have to drink a lot of beer?
You know, the truth of the matter is, Scott, is that this book is written primarily via surveys. But I did go on a trip this summer to South Central, went with the family, wrote it up in the Empire, actually. And while I was out there, I hit as many of these breweries as I could that are in Beers of the North, Field Guide to Alaska and the Yukon, and actually did sort of, you know, taste and enjoy. But it's not really a beer review book so much as a guide to the breweries of the state and Whitehorse.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of, you know, somebody who's coming up here on a road trip, mm-hmm. or coming up on vacation, this would be a great gift for them,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I think people who love beer, this is not a technical book about how to make beer. It's not a ranking of beers. It's just where there are the breweries, what do they offer, and special things to note about the brewery. You know, when they're open, did they serve food? You know, what they had any swag involved in the gift shop? And, you know, that's the kind of information that's in this book. It's definitely a guidebook.
Will you read a little bit out of it? Give us a taste.
Sure. One of the new write-ups, in the first edition, we were lacking a number that already existed, like Midnight Sun Brewing. And so we've added six breweries now, and so the second edition has six more. Here's the opening couple paragraphs from Midnight Sun. A hiker rests on a ridge surrounded by the sharp-edged mountains and broad valleys of Chugach State Park. She squints at the June sun, still bright in the sky. It's midnight, but she hasn't made camp yet because she doesn't have to. The sun is still up. This is an indelible moment that all Alaskans know, the midnight sun warming your shoulders. It is such a defining Alaskan experience that at least 50 businesses in the state include the phrase midnight sun in their name, including Midnight Sun Brewing Company in Anchorage.
Okay. And so that's one example of the writing in the book. What are other things that people can find?
Well, in the book, with the write-up of 26 some odd breweries at this point, which is kind of amazing when you consider Alaska's only 700,000 people. We also in the back have now a number of really great beer recipes. And I don't mean recipes for making beer, but using beer in food recipes, including smoked porter ice cream that was given to us by COPA, Mark Wheeler's COPA. And 49th State Brewing gave us a meatloaf using their seasoning, actually. And then Alaska Brewing gave us an amber mousse stew, recipe. So there's all a bunch of recipes in the back now, which is really cool. We got a glossary, and we have an expanded beer events of the North. So each month there's usually a beer event going on somewhere in the state, and we now have that in the back. The new breweries, or the breweries that have been added, they weren't necessarily new breweries. 49th State Brewery, which was located in Haines, has opened a new brewery in Anchorage. So that's been included. The Glacier Brew House, which has been around forever, is now in the book. So we're excited about that. Same with Midnight Sun Brewing. Odd Man Rush is a new brewery in Eagle River that's in the book. Seward Brewing has been around for a while, but they're now in the book. And then an up-and-coming brewing company called Quake Brewing, which is in Eagle River. They may not actually be open just yet, but they were on the verge.
Okay. So you didn't get to go to all of these.
Not all of them, but I've been to a lot of them.
What kind of beer do you like, Clint?
Right now, I'm really into balance. I don't like overly hopped beers at this point. I did initially. I think that my palate's blown on those. So I'm all about the triples. I really like a good Belgian triple. Kind of sweet, kind of flowery. I enjoy that. And actually, Midnight Sun makes a very good triple ale.
Okay, you're going to be signing this book.
This
on Saturday, right?
That's right. At Nugget Mall from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. At the Hearthside there is their annual sort of holiday book fair. And they have a number of authors will be there signing, myself included. But Ernestine Hayes will be there signing her newest. I believe Riley, one of the calendar people, might be there signing. And there's some other number of other authors as well. So
this is out at Nugget Hearthside.
At Nugget, yep. Nugget Hearthside, 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of local writers and bookstores, you collaborated with Katrina.
Yes. Yes. This book is published by Taku Graphics, which is the sort of guidebook touristy side of Katrina Wolford's business. And so, yes, she's the local person who put all this in motion in the first place about 4 years ago to get this book published.
Okay, so 1 to 3 multiple authors book signing event Nugget.
Yep.
Tis
the season, man.
Tis the season, the holiday season. Get a signed copy.
On top of us here. So come over, get a signed copy. I'll try to be witty. It's no guarantee, and we'll see what happens.
Sounds like fun, Clint. Is there anything else you'd like to share about the book?
I don't, except that it's a really cool, beautiful book. I don't know if you noticed, it's hard to see over a radio, but the artwork and the graphics on it are actually really well done. And the design was by Sarah Asper Smith, who was a local. And then the cover illustration was by Courtney Birdsall Clifford out of Skagway, or Haines, one of those two places up north. And she did amazing work. So it's a pretty book.
All right.
As well as hopefully useful.
Great. Cliff, thanks. Clint, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem. Thank you for listening.
Smoking, I only drink beer.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, November 15th, 2016.
This is Bird Note. What great spectacle would draw a steady stream of birders this time of year to a place well known for being hot and smelly? California's below sea level, Salton Sea, and the irrigated farmlands at its southern end are a mecca for tens of thousands of wintering birds. This inland sea formed when the Colorado River breached floodgates in 1905. Water flowed into the arid Imperial Valley, forming a lake 45 miles long. A century later, the lake has diminished in size and greatly increased in salt concentration, becoming too salty for most aquatic life. But a single introduced fish persists in abundance, the African tilapia. Seabirds, including thousands of brown pelicans, visit the Salton Sea to gobble its fish. The smell comes from occasional massive die-offs of the fish, so abundant that their bones make up the shoreline. Every winter, the salty waters support hordes of water birds, including shorebirds, herons, cormorants, and waterfowl. Great flocks of snow and Ross's geese feed in the farmlands. A cloud of these white birds lifting from a field may make you forget the heat and even the smell. Check out the photos at birdnote.org. Today's show is brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
Thank you for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on the show, Katrina Wolford is she's part of the Friends of the Juno Douglas City Museum. She'll be here to tell us about their annual meeting at the Rockwell and their guest speaker, UAF history professor Terrence Cole. Bill Merck will be here to tell us about the Woosh K open mic, their seventh season. And Theater at Latitude 58 will be here to tell us about White Christmas. And we'll get a report from Eagle Crest. Taking a look at the weather, it's currently 40 degrees at the Juneau Airport. Tonight calls for patchy freezing fog, partly cloudy with a low around 28 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday calls for mostly sunny skies with a high near 39, east winds around 5 miles per hour. Going into Thursday, the forecast calls for partly sunny skies with a high near 36 and east winds around 20 miles per hour. Thank you for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon.